great.
Why'd you bring the glasses?
They're back there. Yeah, his glasses are back there. You'll probably leave them. We'll have to take them down to him like last week. All right, good morning. I think this is the one everybody's been waiting for. We actually get some show and tell and time for questions. Although there's a lot fewer of you here, so I imagine I'll get as many questions as I was expecting. We'll see how that goes. So we're going to start off with, how did the Nephilim, the demons and such, come back after the flood? Because we read in Genesis 6, verse 4, there were giants on the earth in those days and also afterward, which is talking about after the flood, these things came back. And we're curious as to how they came back. There are three main theories. We'll talk about them all today and what is and what is not recorded in history as to how they came back. Spoiler, we don't actually know because no one says specifically this is how it happened. But we do have clues. And so we'll talk about some of those clues today. So as we get into it, everybody's coming in a little bit late. The lineage of the giants, you can see it. You know, Noah had his three sons, Japheth, Ham, and Shem. And I feel sorry for the people on the recording. I have some slides up. You can't see them. This is just the genealogy. We can see from Japheth, there are a couple of giants mentioned in Japheth's lineage outside of the Bible. It's kind of hard sometimes to ascribe which son the giants come through because they often say, the giant started in this region, not through this lineage. People don't own up to we have a giant in our bloodline. So it's more like it came out of the land of Canaan or the land of whoever. And we try and figure out whose land that was. We have Ham, we have Shem. No giants mentioned in Shem's line at all. But Ham, there's a bunch that follow through his. In fact, if you're reading a bunch of stuff about Ham and studying him, you may see some weird stuff where it talks about Ham having the angels brought him knowledge before the flood that they had written things down and that he needed to go collect them after the flood was over. There are writings that say Ham was the first sorcerer. You kind of see some of that stuff pop up right around the time of Christ. The earliest I found the writings where Ham had knowledge that some angelic knowledge, demonic knowledge existed. And then you read those writings over time and they get worse and worse and worse. People kind of embellish those stories until he's the first sorcerer that ever existed. That's all nonsense if you read it. There's no historical record, you know, stuff that really dates back to the flood history that says that happened. But you may see it if you do the study on your own. That's where that comes from. We do have a lot of interesting stuff from Canaan. Canaan was cursed twice, him and his bloodline. So if you recall the story of Noah after the flood had gotten drunk on wine and Ham saw his nakedness and the two brothers brought in a cloak and covered up Noah. And then Noah woke up and he cursed Canaan, not Ham, interesting, cursed Canaan and Canaan's line. Also, when Ham went and divided up the land for his sons, Canaan, Mitzrayim, Put, and Cush, he had given Canaan the land to the south and said, if any of the sons violate the borders that he's kind of distributed for them, there'll be a curse on them. Yeah. Canaan violated that, and he went up the coast along to the north and established that land. So he had a double curse on his lineage, which is interesting because he has a bunch of giants in it. We also have a bunch of giants that come from a fellow named Anak. We don't know who Anak belongs to or what lineage he comes out of. He was in the land of Canaan, and we'll talk about these guys more to go. I just want to show you this lineage. Some interesting things about Anak. The Anakites came out of him. The Arabs record that there was actually, that Anak was actually a woman with a Q, Anak Q, and that she was the mother of King Og of Bashan, who was also happened to be a giant. No real evidence of that, just kind of floating out there. The Egyptians have record of Anak and his sons and them being giants. It doesn't say whose lineage he comes through. Some people talk about Anak's lineage being out of Mitzrayim, but you can't tie it to the Bible. It's just stories that exist out there. But it's interesting from Ham's line, it seems like all of these giants kind of resurface and come out on the earth. We're going to talk about how. I also threw a couple of verses here at the bottom talking about the different names of the Nephilim tribes. So you've got in Deuteronomy, it talks about the Emim that had dwelt in an area at past times. And what's happening here in both these two verses in Deuteronomy, where they're naming the Immim and naming the Zamzumim, is that the Moabites and the Amorites knew about those giants, know the giants that are there now, and say they remind us of the Anakites and these giants and the people that came before them. And so they got that name, probably also based on the characteristics and how they looked. They resembled the ones before, therefore we're calling them these. It's not the same group, so it didn't continue after the flood. They were all destroyed in the flood. But then as they come back, they're like, oh, I recognize how those guys look. They sound like this group. We're going to call them the Immim or the Zimzumim or whatever those names are. And then it continues forward. So a couple other mentions of giants, just so you can see them in your Bible, if you want. We have in Joshua 12:4, we have King Og of Bashan. If you recall, we went through Psalms chapter 22, I believe it was. We talked about the wild beasts of Bashan staring at Christ as he was being crucified. The disembodied demons from the tribe of Bashan. He was the last of the Raphaim. He was apparently pretty tall. There's a bed you can go see touring. Well, I don't know if it's still on the tour, if you can see it, you can go to Israel. But there is what's either Og's table or Og's bed, giant flat stone thing. That's pretty big. We get some mentions of his size, how many cubits he was. So he's somewhere between 13 and a half feet to 16 feet, the bed is. You know. So he would be laying on that. He's a pretty big guy. We hear a bit about the Anakites. Everybody says they're strong and tall, and who can go up against them? And that the men were like grasshoppers in their sight. So we have the 10 spies go in, and they're looking at the promised land and say, well, there's giants there. We're like grasshoppers in their sight. They're really big. And if we look a little further in Samuel and Amos, Amos says that they were as tall as cedars, so that gives us a reference to how tall they may have been, knowing how big the cedar trees were in that area, so we'll use that as a reference. They weren't lanky, they were, you know, strong as oaks. Some people recordings say that they were strong like a mountain, big and well-built is kind of the imagery you get there, not skinny and frail like you see really tall humans that just keep growing and they can barely walk around. These guys were strong and scary. We also get Goliath here. What's interesting when it talks about his spear size being that of a weaver's beam, those were pretty large, the weaver's beams that they had to build, rugs and tapestries and stuff. I mean, that may be a 12 to 13 foot long beam that they'd be running across to build stuff with. Plus, he would have his spear on top of that, so giant beam. Also, interesting to note, he had the six fingers and six toes. Some of the giants had those. There's also recordings of them having two rows of teeth and other weird things that went about them. This is where we get the American Indians doing their greeting of how from a distance, raising their hand up because they would count the fingers before they would go and approach somebody who was unknown to them at a distance, because they know the giant tribes or the ones they encountered here typically had six fingers and six toes. Do you have a question, Tony? You looked at me like you were at a... No? Okay. So let's look at the size of these guys. Here you see on the left a 6 foot tall human. Then we've got the scale all the way on the far right. So the size of cedar trees in that region of Lebanon and Canaan or whatever, they get up to about 36 feet tall. Then they would go from 24 to 36. So there are some pretty tall guys. You can imagine if you were going into the promised land and you saw this 36 foot tall guy and looking at you just come above his ankle as a 6 foot tall fella, that you would be like a grasshopper in his sight. You would look pretty tiny and be pretty afraid. This is probably also where you get the information about Achilles and his weakness being the heel, because somebody the size of a man would be attacking that tendon on giants to get them to fall down and be unable to run or fight. And then you could slay the guy. So that would be where I would attack as a tiny little man fighting a big giant fella. And as we go down, we get the Og of Bashan scale, so this 18 to 12 foot guy, still pretty darn tall and pretty darn scary. And you go down to more of a Goliath scale, which would be like the 9 feet to 12 feet kind of guy. Still pretty tall, still pretty terrible. Still not a good time if I'm an Israeli or Israelite trying to take the promised land and move into the lands God promised me. If I was one of the 10 spies that went in, I might also say, what are you guys thinking? No, this is a suicide mission. Let's not go forward. These guys do get mentioned outside of the Bible in history books. I'm sure you've all heard of Josephus before. He was a Jewish historian. One of the things he shared was back before the temple was destroyed in 70 AD, was that they had giant bones on display there for everyone to see. So that no one would ever forget that these days existed and what the Israelites went through to take the promised land. They had the bones of the giants and weapons of the giants and things on display to see what it was God helped them overcome. So it's interesting to know that it's just out there. You've got it. So then how do these things come back? This is what we're going to talk about today. And if I could get somebody to go ahead and queue up 1 Corinthians 11, 1 through 16. Jill, you want to do that for me?
Sure.
We'll go over that in a little bit. So we have no record of a second incursion happening. What that means is people have often speculated that after the flood happened and all of the corruption was wiped off the earth and the 200 angels that came down and didn't keep their first estate, that apparently another angel or group of angels must have come down and restarted this process. It could have happened. It probably didn't happen, but don't know that for sure. We have recordings outside the Bible that talk about the judgment of the 200 angels that didn't keep their first estate that went into Tartarus or the abyss. In those writings, it even says in some places that the righteous angels trembled at the judgment handed down to the unrighteous. It was that scary for them. So I find if that's the case, it's probably unlikely that they did it again. But Paul is actually afraid this could happen. And understanding what Paul's talking about actually helps you understand quite a bit of stuff in your Bible. And if you would, Jill, would you read this for me? It's a really, sounds like it's a contradictory section of scripture. Go ahead.
Be imitators of me as I am of Christ. Now I commend you because you remember me in everything and maintain the traditions even as I deliver them to you. But I want you to understand that the head of every man is Christ, the head of a wife is her husband, and the head of Christ is God. Every man who prays or prophesies with his head covered dishonors his head. But every wife who prays or prophesies with her head uncovered dishonors her head, since it is the same as if her head were shaven. For if a wife will not cover her head, then she should cut her hair short. But since it is disgraceful for a wife to cut off her hair or shave her head, let her cover her head. For a man ought not to cover his head, since he is the image and glory of God. But woman is the glory of man. For man was not made from woman, but woman from man. Neither was man created for woman, but woman for man. That is why a wife ought to have a symbol of authority on her head, because of the angels. Nevertheless, in the Lord, woman is not independent of man, nor man of woman. For as woman was made from man, so man is now born of woman. And all things are from God. Judge for yourselves. Is it proper for a wife to pray to God with her head uncovered? Does not nature itself teach you that if a man wears long hair, it is a disgrace for him? But if a woman has long hair, it is her glory? For her hair is given to her for a covering. If anyone is inclined to be contentious, we have no such practice, nor do the churches of God.
That sounds kind of weird and isn't really clear, is it? It sounds like Paul's telling us that a woman should have her head covered, that it's the decent thing to do. For some reason, we do it because we're thinking about the angels. But then God gave her hair for a covering, and that is her covering. That was God's plan. But yeah, he's telling her to cover it anyway. It sounds weird. Until you understand that what Paul is talking about is the birds and the bees as he understands it. So in that time, it was believed, if you go read a fellow named Hippocrates, that hair was part of the reproductive process. So that if a woman wanted to be more fertile, she would have long hair because it had a vacuum effect, they believed, to help with the fertilization process. So one of the reasons women even today shave their legs, shave their armpits, do all that stuff, was to be more fertile and be able to give birth easier. That's why she would have long hair and, you know, nice shaved legs that we all appreciate. But At least I think all of us appreciate it. And so when you read things about temple prostitutes in the Bible and they have their head shaved, they're practicing what they believe to be a form of birth control. Because if their head's shaved, then it's inhibiting that process of fertility as they believe it. On the flip side with the men, if they have long hair, that vacuum effect would make them less fertile because their job is to, you know, to fertilize. And so if they were unable to do that or trying to practice birth control of their own, their hair would be longer. And since God told us to go out and be fruitful and multiply, then if you were going against God, it would be shameful then for you to have that long hair and not be fruitful and multiply. Tony's looking at me like, what is all this stuff? I could go read Hippocrates if you want. It talks about woman being just a giant womb walking around. That's what they believed. It's a really interesting read. But that's where these things come from. What's interesting about this is that Paul is afraid that women with their hair uncovered, it being part of the reproductive process, would, you know, you would think that you would, for decency's sake, you would cover that up because you wouldn't want to tempt anybody if it was a reproductive organ. That's what he's getting at here. And if it's a reproductive organ, you wouldn't want to put it on display for the angels and tempt them to want to come back and restart this process of mating with women. So it would be right then to cover it up in public, in church, and for the sake of the angels to keep it covered so they're not tempted. Now, I've read in some manuscript that one of the things that the angels, as they became flesh and left their first estate, that they saw women with their long flowing fine hair looking fair and lusted after that hair. Now, I can't find that exact reference anymore. I tried looking for it. There's just too many documents out there. I did find references from about around the time of Christ and a little bit before, about 100 years before, that talks about the same thing, where you shouldn't tempt the angels by putting on makeup and having your hair shown, that you didn't want it to cause this. So Paul may be getting it from there. And it may be that this whole idea of hair being a part of the reproductive process was because the angels lusted after it. And so that mindset carried into modern times and affected how we view our medical practice. Don't know that for sure. Or it was that humanity thought that that was a part of reproduction and we're worrying so much about the angels being tempted that we should make sure we cover up all of our private parts and, you know, not tempt them to come down and restart this mixing with humanity and taking wives of all who they chose. But Paul understood that this wasn't God's plan. That's why he says God gave them hair as a covering. Like that's, he knows that's the right thing, but he also knows currently with how society thinks that hair should be covered because it's indecent. It's a part of your reproductive organs. Let's cover it up. It's just a decent thing to do. That's what Paul is getting at in this particular conversation, which really helps you reading your Bible when you see about all these women with shorn heads or guys with long hair that are shaved. Like, what are they talking about there? They're talking about this. That's where it's coming from. Question.
So like every depiction of Jesus then about his hair?
Well, we don't actually know what he looks like. We have those depictions. I think we know what he looks hair. Like. Yeah, but the hair thing isn't actually a sin. It's a heart problem. And so it's a sin here because they believe it, he's trying, you know, as a man, I'm trying to practice birth control or to be promiscuous and not get a woman pregnant. And so I'm sinning in that regard. It's not the hair itself. It's the heart condition behind the hair. Just like it wouldn't. There's nothing wrong with a woman with a shaved head or no hair on her head. That's no big deal. It's not shameful. It's just, at the time, it would have been. Any other questions? Tony's still looking at me like I...
The way I look.
Yeah, so that's one theory of how it happened. Don't know if any of that took place. Could have been. You just don't know. The second theory is that the wives of the sons of Noah may not have been genetically pure. Now, this was one that I thought until I came across the third theory that was most likely the case, because we have mentions, of course, of Noah and his sons being genetically pure. We don't have any mention of his wives being genetically pure. We have mentioned that the earth and all flesh are corrupted. So you'd think if all flesh is corrupted, wouldn't that mean the wives of the sons of Noah were a part of that all flesh? could be. You know, Noah built the ark. Then we have the first mention of these wives of the sons being about 7 days before the flood. They went and chose their wives. Now, that's probably didn't happen that way, given the way that the culture worked. They probably would have been betrothed. They would have had some time as they prepared a place for these wives. They would have known each other. It's probably not just like, I'm going to take, you know, I've got 7 days. She's mine. I'm taking that one. That's probably not how it worked. There's probably a relationship here for a long time. And then they went and got them before the flood happened, but they were already betrothed. That's likely what happened. They very well may have been pure. We don't know. But it's one of the theories as to how this occurred. And this would be like genetic abnormalities would eventually manifest themselves. Those recessive traits as they had children, where you have green eyes, blue eyes, brown eyes. You know, you might have normal-sized humans, giant humans, kind of what they were thinking. Yep.
So the wives, if they weren't, or if they were genetically pure, then that would mean their parents were genetically pure also.
That is what that would mean, yeah.
So I wonder why.
Well, they may not have been morally pure. They could have been pretty terrible people. We don't, I don't know. There's, I'm sure God had a reason, a very just reason why they were, you know, part of the flood. Or they may have died, for all we know. They may not have been alive anymore. You don't know what was happening there. Part of the story that's just conveniently left out for us, which I wish we had somewhere, but sadly we don't. Then we have theory three, which to me is the most interesting one, because we have a little bit of historical information that says this may have actually happened. So in Jubilees 8, we have a recording after the flood. Remember I said that Canaan went up, he was given the land in the south, but he went up the coast in the north instead, and he and his son founded a city called Sidon or Zidon up along the coastline. What's interesting about that location is it is the closest seaport you can get to Mount Hermon, which is where those angels came down to make their oath and start this program of intermingling with humans and making monsters and giants and things. So Canaan went up that way for some reason. He must have known something was there. And he found writings of that former generation. So he went and found this knowledge of the watchers or the angels that left their first estate and came down. And it says here he learned omens of the sun, moon, and stars and signs of heaven. And didn't say anything about it because he knew Noah would be really upset about it if he had gone and collected this stuff. So this is where we get our first clue that maybe something happened here. There was a book that was uncovered called the Book of Giants. It's in the Dead Sea Scrolls. There was another copy that was about from 150 years after Christ that's really badly fragmented and can't get much out of it. But the Dead Sea Scroll version actually, it's still fragmented, but it's more intact. And that gives us some really good clues as to what was likely happening to bring all of these back. There was a series of writings or books in the Middle Ages called grimoires. And what a grimoire was, and then I'll go back to this book, is it would tell you, like, hey, if you go take a pear and two apples and you burn them together, it creates this chemical that can let you interact with, you know, the spiritual realm or create some sort of mind-altering experience and weird things like that. And we know from science, that's all bogus. That stuff's not real. Those things were all made up. If we read a document that tells us about doing breeding programs and genetic manipulation, that today in our current medical science, we know is actually how that works. We know the people back then didn't actually know how genetics worked and how chromosomes worked and all of this kind of stuff. But science has told us that the things they were doing from that ancient document can be done. Then we probably know that that ancient document, the Book of Giants is what I'm referring to, was real knowledge given by somebody with advanced knowledge beyond what humans knew. So it was probably something that was handed down from the angels. So the Book of Giants, what it is, and it actually is possible, is part of it tells how to go about recreating what are called, well, the Nephilim, the giants, monsters, so breeding creatures together to create other creatures, what you would do is it says somebody of, that's got some money and some time on their hands, would take 200 of all these different kinds of animals. And it talks about taking a horse and a donkey and you create a mule, or taking a ram and a sheep and you create whatever that creature is. You can breed them together and you get another creature that's typically sterile. They wouldn't be able to breed or do anything. But if you have enough of them and enough time, you can breed them until they get to the point where a mule can self-sustain and give birth to another mule if you mate them together, or is able to mate with something else. And so what it's saying is, as you go through and do this mating program with these animals, you create, take something like, I forget one of the chromosomes. I think a horse has 60 and a donkey has 56 or something. It creates one of like 57. It's something like that. But you create what's called an unstable animal, one that can't reproduce, a mule. But if you do enough of them, you get genetic mutations where they can reproduce. And so this unstable animal of a certain chromosome level, once you get it to where it can reproduce and self-sustain, you can find another creature with a similar chromosome count. And this is what science tells us. It wasn't known back then. And you can mate them and you'll get an offspring that would typically spontaneously abort. But the history books talk about herbal medicine that they would give them to stop that process so that they would bring these creatures to term. And if you did it long enough, they'll be able to self-sustain, and then you can breed them with something else. And it talks about breeding cattle with birds. At some point, you get to where they can reproduce. It talks about doing it with people. So you would take people or slaves, at least 200 of them. You'd have at least 200 of every kind and start this program of mixing them together in order to get this different species. Now, when the angels had done this, the fallen angels, the first time around before the flood, creating all the corruption on the earth, the history books record that as being working pretty well. There were very few monsters. When you get with what the humans were doing with it, there, since they didn't know exactly how to do this, they weren't a part of watching creation be done. They kind of went off of memory and stuff that they had in notes, like the Book of Giants, to try this as trial and error. They made lots of terrible creatures and things just outright called monsters. The things that you probably see in all of the, mythology, where it talks about satyrs and Pegasus and different things like that. And the monsters would go and consume people. There are records of these monsters in the stories of Jubilees and Jasher and whatever the history books, where if you recall, in the Bible, we have Joshua going around and taking out all the giants in Canaan. And there's these campaigns that run where different folks in the Bible say, they're going to go, I'm going up into the mountainside. There's giants up there right here. I'm going to go kill them. We get stories of that also in the history books where it's like, oh, I was out tending to my flock and I saw these creatures come out of the sea and there were donkeys along the beach and they went and rode them, then started eating them and then drug them all out into the sea. And it says, oh, somebody out there is mixing animals because they made monsters. And you need to get some men together and go out and wipe them all out and figure out who this is. You've got to kill this off because people are doing practices they shouldn't do. And so they would go off and do these things. Interesting enough, we have another fella in the Bible that seems to be, he may be a part of all this. So if we look to the far right here, we have the one giant called Nimrod. Nimrod, it seems like, may have been using some of this knowledge. If you read in the book of Jubilees, it says that Noah had some of Adam's clothes, a cloak or something that he had carried down. And that when Nimrod was about 20 years old, he put on Adam's clothes and would wear them around as he hunted and did whatever. He was, at one point, normal-sized guy, decent fellow, seemed to be following the Lord, and then he went sideways. So it says that he was, came from Cush. He began to be a mighty man on the earth, or a man of renown, a Giborim. And he was a mighty hunter before the Lord, or in spite of the Lord, or in his face. Mm-hmm. Wherefore it is said, even as Nimrod, the mighty hunter before the Lord, and then he goes on to his story about founding Babel and whatever. The interesting about him becoming Giborim, or becoming a man of renown, is kind of where we get the interesting bits here. So just some of his background, he was the conqueror of the pre-flood world, so he was kind of the first world king. He founded Babylon, this giant city, and in Babylon, of course, they were trying to build this tower to pierce the heavens, do something with the heavens. likely what people believe that he was trying to cross that veil or interact with that veil in some way, not just get really high up in the sky. His name means to rebel or let us rebel. He is thought to be, to move forward, two-thirds God, one-third man is what's recorded outside of the Bible in the writings about him. The word began there in our Bibles is one to, that's not just I've started a thing, but it's a way of profaning or doing some desecration or polluting myself in some sort of ritual or sexual way. We know he did that stuff. It's recorded outside the Bible that he tried to mate with all kinds of other creatures. Not only was he doing mixing things, it refers to, but he himself was trying to mate with other animals and stuff and create these kind of monsters. It's outside the Bible, but it's recorded that he was doing that. He was just considered rather wild and just doing things to provoke God, really. But then you get stories about him. If you look in on the internet or anywhere else about stories, Gilgamesh is one of the ones that is referred to as Nimrod. Different groups of people call them by different names. Gilgamesh was one of them. If you look at statues of Nimrod, he seems to be like from Nimrod to Gilgamesh, they all draw the same guy. This guy with a beard who's really tall, who holds lions like they're kittens. That was one of the things that is brought up again and again about Nimrod. He was a big guy, and he just manhandled a lion. So somehow, he became this man of renown, which is an allusion to the men of renown in Genesis 6, the Giborim, became this giant thing. We don't know how, unless he had some of this knowledge and was trying to mix himself or do genetic manipulation, is what we assume in some way. But he became really, really big. Any questions about him before I move on, or about the Book of Giants? Because we can go into that a little bit more, too. So I left time to talk about these things. Anybody has questions? Yes?
I think that the Antichrist is going to take a similar pattern.
That's interesting. So news about Gilgamesh. Before the Iraq War, when we went in there the first time, the city of Uruk, if I remember right, which was the city that Nimrod had founded along with Babylon and some other, it was all in that same region. They said that they had found the tomb of Nimrod and the tomb of Gilgamesh and his whole city. 5 months after it was said that the archaeologists believed they found it, we went into Iraq. We set up a military base directly on top of this city and began taking artifacts out of it. And if you want to do a Freedom of Information Act request or look at CIA.gov, there is information on there about some of the items we returned because they wanted some of them back. So there's a list of things, some redacted, some we sent back, that we were taking out of this site. So the Tomb of Gilgamesh has what's called a resurrection chamber in it. The story of Gilgamesh and Nimrod back then said that he would resurrect in the last days and be a part of the Antichrist thing. Or they would use his DNA. It's not biblical. It's just stories that exist out there about this particular individual that you would see him come back or his likeness come back. And it's just an interesting story, an interesting coincidence that we put a military base right on top of that city. Also, the UN has a military base right on top of Mount Hermon, if you didn't know that. So where the angels came down, the watchers, you can't go there. There's a military base there. I don't know why the UN has a military base there, but it's a UN establishment. Likely looking for artifacts and information. Hitler did the same thing. So he went all over the place looking for relics and artifacts. He was very into the occults. One of the reasons he went down into Antarctica, I think, is because there are mentions of it in the Book of Enoch, where it says there were some angels imprisoned there. And it gives at the southernmost part of the earth. And it gives description of the mountain range, which is pretty easy to identify. And that those angels are allowed to deceive men. And that's kind of the end of it. You don't know who they are. You don't know what they did. Just there's a mountain range there where they're imprisoned, but they're able to deceive people still. And so think that maybe our government, a bunch of governments go down there all the time. I mean, almost every leader has been to Antarctica. And so it's just interesting that there's that talk in Enoch, and our governments of the world seem to be really interested in that area of the globe, even though there's nothing there. conspiracy theory stuff. Don't know if any of that's real. It's just interesting. Any other questions about that? So we don't know if he's going to be part of the Antichrist. There's hints, like when you talk about the image of Daniel with the 10 toes of clay mixed with iron, but for the seed, right? There might be some Nephilim thing going on. Maybe those 10 kings are part of the seed of Satan, the Nephilim guys. Don't know. We'll talk about that next week.
The whole hybrid thing is becoming really popular by the age.
What's interesting is, are they actually gone? Because we see over time how the giants get smaller and start going towards the size of humans. Are they still around? I don't know. Probably, I'm still around. Don't know if they're all gone or not. All right, moving on. We're going to start talking about some of these skulls and stuff here now. So you've probably seen a lot of the Egyptian stuff and different artifacts where you've got these people with long necks and big bulbous heads that kind of hang back because their back of their head's so big. I think that's where they get the idea of the long necks, and those people put the rings on their necks to make it really long because you've got these folks. And where we get the idea of the cranial headboarding to make this shape where I think it's beautiful. And you see it a lot, especially in the Egyptian area and places where they built these monoliths and giant stuff where we wonder how man could have done it, or do we just have a lot of slaves to build these giant stone buildings that have 20-ton, 80-ton stones. There's no way we could in our modern technology move them up a mountainside and put them there. How'd they do it? Well, we see carvings of people like that around them all the time. And we've got a couple other skulls over here. If you look at the one on the top right on the screen, this is a skull of an artifact called Cinnamon. It's believed to be a Nephilim, Raphaim, some sort of skull. If you notice, the eye sockets are quite large compared to a human. The cranium itself is quite large. If you look at cranial headboarding, when people actually shape their heads to look in this shape, the human skull is only about 1,100 cubic centimeters of volume inside of it. So no matter how you smush it, move it, the volume is going to be the volume. It doesn't get bigger than that. Unless you just happen to be a really large human, you might get a couple extra centimeters in there. These skulls start at about 1,500 cubic centimeters and get larger. So there's much more cranial capacity inside these things. And so you can't get that by shaping it. I do have a copy of the skull on the bottom here. This is of a young child or baby. And we'll look at some of the cranial headboarding stuff in a minute. The thing about this skull is it had red hair on it, so you can't see it's actually going on with the skull itself and the anatomy of it. What it doesn't have, it also got some really big eye sockets compared to the size of it. But if it was a headboarded skull and you put a board on it and likely you wrapped something around it, you would have an indention also in the sides because it's compressing all the way around uniformly. And this one doesn't. So it looks like it was naturally born that way. This one down. I'll move forward to the other things. We're going to talk about some of the other parts of the skulls. Oh, here's some of the headboarding, just so you can see what it is. Looks really comfortable here. If you look at the bottom left, yeah, with that board smashed against the kid. Makes some interesting shapes in the head. It's very angular. It's not quite the same shape as what we see in some of the Caracas skulls, the giant skulls. You've got the woman here on the far right that's got bandages wrapped around to try and elongate the skull. But you can see how it's making these deformations. They're pinching spots. And so you see, if you look at what's a real cranial headboarded skull, you're going to see where there's parts where it was squeezed together and parts of the skull is trying to push its way out. And it looks like, you know, you're putting a rubber band around my sleeve and like the fat muscles squeezing out around it. It does that with the skull too. And so when you don't see those type of patterns in the skull, it was natural. Or it should be natural. Interesting things about the skulls of what we think are Nephilim versus human skulls is if you look at the human skull, it's the third picture over to the right. It's got, this is called the parietal plate here, the plate that goes around the back of my head. It typically has a suture in it called a syncytial suture that runs down the center. None of these Caracas skulls have that. They have one single parietal plate. Now, there is a disease where that suture can fuse in a human, typically has around 50 to 60 years of age. Occasionally, there are children born with it, but by and large, we all have that suture all the time. It was theorized that if it was a genetic defect and kids were born with it, that's what caused this shape and made these skulls look the way they did, because they couldn't explain all of the shape of the skulls. Scientists couldn't, because they could tell that they weren't all headboarded because they didn't have tool markings on them. They said, well, it must be that there's a disease that causes that to fuse and it just causes the head to grow really weird. Study came out, I think it was about 2016, that had researched this and said, matter of fact, if you're born with a fused parietal plate, your head grows normal. It doesn't misshapen. It's okay. So the lack of a syncytial suture does not cause this shape of skull. It's something else. And you guys are welcome to come up and handle these things whenever you want. The other thing about this is you don't see it so much in this one because it's pretty small. But if I were to take, actually, let me go back a couple slides. If you were to look at this skull of the lady here that's been drawn, or even if I had a sideways view of Cinnamon there, you would see that the spine comes in really just behind the area of the mouth and the esophagus. And typically in humans, that's further back on the skull, which means our heads sit forward and we look forward, with the part where the spine comes into the skull being further towards the center. It means you've always got to have your head kind of tilted. And so all that weight back there means you're balancing it. So now you're looking up and at people more often than you're looking straight ahead. There's just an interesting spot when you look at these things. The spine position is further forward than it would be in a human. And there's other different artifacts and things about these that are off. What you'll find a lot is these different skulls, you'll have the nose plate broken off. And that is because archaeologists wanted to look more ape-like. So if they can't explain it, they'll take a little hammer and pop that out. Well, apes have a bigger cavity in their nose, and so they'll make it look like an ape and then pass it off as an ape skull rather than something they can't explain. So you'll see that quite a bit. You've got this really interesting pronounced ridge here, and you can see a little indention. This is what people are trying to mimic as they do the cranial headboarding, is this thing. Because they apparently thought these people were beautiful for some reason, and so they were trying to put a board here, some rope around here. They would squeeze the skull and make an indention, a ring around it, and thought it looked pretty. But pretty interesting. If you look at some of the pictures I have here inside these books, you'll see like the a normal size human jaw and teeth, and you'll see the giant ones that are sitting way out here. And these are really small ones. They get quite a bit bigger. These skulls run about $350 a piece. If I wanted to get a copy of Cinnamon, that's the one that's on the top right there, that's about $1,000. And if I wanted to get the real big ones, I'm looking at $5,000 to get a model skull. And I think my wife would probably kill me if I'm spending money. So I didn't get to buy big skulls like that. They do happen to be all over the United States.
Hey, Chip?
Yeah.
So far, in a round number, how many of these have they found?
Oh, I don't know. Peru has a ton of them in their museums. You can just go there, their natural history museums, and look at them. They're not as big on censoring information as we are here in the United States and in the West. So you can find them in third world countries. And there's even some museums that had full giant skeletons in them. You can see the whole thing standing up there, just like you would a dinosaur.
You think it was intentional that they hid this part of our history?
Yep. It's in the books. So if you look at this one in particular, what this individual has done in the United States is gone through and looked at all of the newspaper records on microfiche and whatever, pulled them out with all of the recordings of giants being uncovered in the United States as we were conquering the land and creating them farmland and whatnot. There's all kinds of records in there, tons and tons of records. Universally, what was done is that the Smithsonian government was offering farmers or people money to send these, off to the Smithsonian for research and study, and they would just disappear. But the newspapers, local newspapers at the time, being locally owned, would put all the information in there about what they found and say, well, we found a 10-footer or an 8-footer, whatever. This one had two rows of teeth. This one had six fingers and six toes. This one looked this way. It had these giant weapons with it. And pictures of it would be taken and it would be sent off. That was done for quite a while. They were all found in mounds. And what happened was our government said, we're no longer allowed to dig up any mounds. Those are Indian grounds. And the Indians say, that's not Indian burial grounds. Those are giant burial grounds. They know the difference. There is actually, in my hometown of Evansville, Indiana, we have along the Ohio River, what's called a historical Indian site. It's called Angel Mounds is the name of it. The local Indians all know that everything in the mounds on that site isn't theirs, but society, everybody around says that was an Indian site. You're not allowed to dig on any of that stuff. The local Indians say all of that Ohio Valley area was cursed. We have giant serpent mounds there, all kinds of weird stuff. Yeah.
There's a park in Anderson, Indiana called Mounds. I think it's a state park, I believe.
Yeah, I think you're right.
Great big mounds, and they explain it as Indian burial sites.
Yes, we also have a spot called Garden of the Gods, which is big giant stones moved around and different weird stuff and mounds and stuff in it. It's really pretty, but it was considered their abode or their place to be at. So the whole area is full of stuff like that in southern Indiana on through Ohio. Any other comments or questions on that?
Well, what's the purpose of hiding that?
Usually when I talk about this, I put Napoleon's quote up where he says, history is a set of lies agreed upon. I think the reason is that our governments, they're not run by, moral, ethical people. We have Satan's kind of in control of the world. We've abdicated that through our fall. He's the power of the prince of the air. He's got his people in established, trying to set things up for his kingdom and to thwart the plans of God. He's, trying to get ready for whenever the rapture happens. He's got a little bit of time left. So he's trying to either prevent that or then get ready for what needs to happen right after that. So he's been kind of laying the groundwork to make sure everybody's deceived, but then he can bring his message forward. So I think it's just this idea of a shadow government or Satan's government trying to keep us all in the dark. And there's enough of the stuff that leaks out so that we can all be called conspiracy theorists or nut jobs, seeing this from other countries. Yeah, go ahead, Tony.
I was going to just say, and part of what we're talking about, we won't be next week, but 2 weeks.
Oh, yeah.
We have no problem as Christians thinking about Satan being involved in biblical history. We have a little bit of, maybe a lot of problem, believe me, still doing it today. And for some reason, we've disconnected those two, like he's taking a vacation. And like you were saying, that he's been involved all this time laying the foundation for what he hopes, is a attempted coup.
Yeah.
That's not going to happen, but that's what he's moving for.
Right. Any other questions?
Well, so could it be that knowledge and delving into this would prove the validity of Scripture?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
And so that's the spiritual battle.
They're going to push evolution. That's what I was thinking of. Is that this doesn't jive.
Doesn't jive, right.
Yeah, I heard the quote, history is a wonderful thing, if only it were true.
Another thing I would say, if you always haven't noticed, in the last 6 months, specifically, on the news thing, it was just the other night again, they're pushing, do UFOs exist? Do these people exist? Oh, yeah. I mean, it's become very prevalent.
That's what I was just going to say. Future right is up.
Yeah.
Did you guys see
the whole Anunnaki thing and everything falls right into that?
Did you see just last week there was a headline where we have brought back an extinct species that looks kind of like a zebra? It's like a mix of a donkey and a zebra. And it got brought back through genetic manipulation. And they've got about a dozen of them now that they're trying to keep alive. We can talk about that next week.
Yeah, and that's part of that where Daniel says in the last days, knowledge will increase. He's talking about more Gnosticistic type knowledge, not just we're getting smarter.
We're certainly not getting wiser. Yeah.
A lot of Indian mounds in the so-called Indian mounds in Wisconsin. I don't know if they are, but interestingly, a lot of them are at Devil's Lake.
Oh, that's interesting. This particular book actually has it all classified by state. So you can go look up your state and see all the stuff that was found.
Well,
I said, you want to look through it and see what's going on in Wisconsin, wherever you can. Yeah.
There's like a lot of universal symbolism as well from like Egyptian.
Oh, yeah. Egyptian, oh, yeah.
Indian, like the obelisks, the dome shaped buildings, mm-hmm. all that stuff being like
everywhere.
Racist and raw and all that.
Yep. But
that's like, it's, I mean, it's even on the back of our dollars.
Yeah. Washington Monument.
Yeah.
The last thing I'll say before I interrupt you. So, people don't see this, but the abortion issue plays right into this also, and the genetic manipulation from the cells they take from the baby. It's all part of this whole thing.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Yeah, I couldn't imagine the amount of babies that were aborted or spontaneously aborted as they were going through some of this mixing animals with people, trying to figure it all out. The amount of, I mean, it describes the amount of death was enormous trying to do this stuff. At least in the history books. So it was not a just a fun experiment for scientists to run. It had a real cost to it.
I think they've gone way further than what we even imagined already.
Yeah, yeah, there's
it's there already.
It's there. So people wonder how some of the giant monoliths and structures were built. If you actually read the symbolism on them, I think it tells you. Look at some of it. So here we've got some Egyptian stuff. They're setting up one of these. It's not what it's called, an obelisk. I guess it's a column. You see two giant beings and one normal-sized being trying to set the thing up. Seems straightforward. You've got, I believe this is from like the Gilgamesh area. So you've got a small human, and then these giants like taking stuff off a tree and carrying things around. I like this one quite a bit, because this is talking about some of the stuff that they had found that just disappears. This is a giant propped up against a rail car. Pretty big guy. They found it in Ireland and were taking it away. Here's one that went to the Smithsonian on the other side. It's a 10-foot coffin. So this guy's probably about 9 feet tall stuck in it. If you look real close, I'm going to walk away from the camera. I apologize. On this one, you can count 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 fingers. You can't see the thumb because it's down. So he's a 6-fingered fella that's inside this coffin. So interesting that it's big. Here's some of the giants discovered here in the Americas. So you got one big giant guy in Pennsylvania is 18 feet tall. He's a big guy. There are in these books here too. This one I thought was really interesting. This one is Chief Joseph Riverman. There was a discovery in Michigan of what they called an Indian sword, is what they had said in the museum. Problem with that, Indians didn't make swords. Where did they work bronze? So the museum is real sharp. What the chief said, he goes, oh, we have stories of this. It said that the giants, their spears were so large that they could go through 3 braves. It's the spear of a lance. And so he stood next to it to show that it's big enough to go through 3 fellas. Because it was the giants that worked bronze. It wasn't the Indians. His whole thing, Chief Joseph Riverman, I should have brought his book. He talks about how the storytellers of the different Indian tribes, that the great creator has been telling them to start sharing with everyone the story of what's coming. Because the stories they don't tell the white man, their own stories, actually line up pretty close with what the Bible says. They have stories about Nunu and the great canoe, and the great creator, and a story of a flood of fire and a flood of water and all the different things that are coming. So it lines up pretty close, and that they're supposed to be sharing now what they've been taught about the end times. And so he goes out and is sharing different Indian stories that line up with scripture. It's pretty interesting. This is another one that I like. It's got a lady sitting on one of these like Sphinx type things. Yeah, thank you. I was trying to get the word in my head. We always wonder, how were they made? Well, on this Sphinx type thing is this image where it shows these big giant guys sitting on the thing, carving and polishing it. And you see the size of a normal lady right there next to it. So probably big giant folks actually made the thing. Well, I imagine that symbolism is saying, I don't speak whatever language that is, but I don't know what that says. We have giant footprints in different rocks and stones that are everywhere. You can actually see footprints with dinosaur tracks up in Tuba City here in Arizona, if you get the right guide and ask about it, you know, oh, are there human prints with the dinosaur prints? Sure, I'll take you right to them. You guys have seen it, right? Yep, kids have been up there. I didn't get to go. And I can send all this stuff out afterwards. You've got more pictures, like in Egypt, of these giant people and normal human people tending to them. Big giant person there, little bitty people. Looks like the Anakite size, you know, the 36-foot tall person with little bitty 6-foot tall humans helping them out. This stuff is all over the place in ancient Egypt, everywhere else. Yeah.
I have a question about the footprints. How would they be permanent?
Permanent?
Yeah.
Does it mean they haven't been eroded by wind or water or whatever? Is that being permanent?
Yeah, it looks like it's like permanent inside the rock. Like how?
Yeah, so a lot of these stones would be sedimentary stones or stuff that at one point would have been like wet mud or different things that they could have stepped in and then dried and had that stuck in there and just left over time as it dried out, or fossilized as different minerals went into whatever that was. I actually almost brought in a picture of a fossilized pickle. So a pickle was dropped in a mineral-rich water body, and within 70 years, it is a complete fine fossil, just like everything else you see from the dinosaurs and stuff. So you don't have to have millions of years for fossils to be made. Really quick. As the minerals move into different porous rocks or porous bodies. It's just a culmination of all those different pictures all put together. You will hear sometimes people talk about these things, that if it's a big person versus a little person, it's a symbol of authority. The big person was in charge, and all the little people were slaves, is how you'll hear that interpreted by secular society. And that was all I had for the pictures.
Or maybe they just wrote it as they seen it.
Maybe. Go ahead. Now we've got we're just about out of time. A couple minutes left. If you guys would like, you're welcome to come up here and handle the skulls, look through the books. I know you wanted to borrow the book of Enoch and Joshua. That, you can take it with you. I'm done with that now. Yep, all yours. And then I'm here for 2 weeks from now. Yes, Tony wants me to remind everybody, next week we have Thanksgiving. Week after that, we'll be back up here. So 2 weeks from now, we'll finish up. Go ahead.
Are these fallen angels part of the one-third that Satan took with him? Are they separate? Are they continuing to fall?
That's a good question.
Are angels continuing to fall right now?
I don't think so.
There's no reference at all. Yeah. It happened one time.
So they're part of the one-third.
Yeah.
That doesn't mean there's not a possibility that those, that there, some of the fallen angels will not leave their first estate again when they know time. There's an indication where Jesus said he knows his time is short. So there's an indication that could happen again. Or it could be the genetic manipulation from the extra knowledge.
Thank you.
Yeah, you don't know.